Today we'll report on methane. It appears it's on the rise in the atmosphere. NPR's Richard Harris reports on why efforts to control methane are faltering.
Methane gas comes from all sorts of sources: wetlands, rice paddies, cow tummies, coal mines, leaking natural gas pipes, garbage dumps, even termites. Drew Schindel at NASA's Goddard Institute in New York says it's built up dramatically in the atmosphere.
It's gone up by 150% since the pre-industrial period. So that's an enormous increase. CO2, by contrast, has only gone up by about 30%.
Molecule for molecule, methane is much more effective at trapping heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. And that's just part of the trouble.
Methane is much more complicated once it gets into the atmosphere than something like carbon dioxide is. And that's because it reacts with a lot of different important chemicals.
For example, methane in the atmosphere also creates ground-level ozone. And ozone isn't only bad for human health, it also contributes to global warming. Schindel recently totaled up all the effects of methane emissions and realized that the heating effect is a not-too-distant second to carbon dioxide.
So that tells you that methane is actually a pretty big player.
Methane in the atmosphere leveled off in the 1990s, so it looked for a time that efforts to control industrial emissions were keeping this problem gas in check. But since 2007, methane levels have been on the rise again. A study published in Science magazine suggests that at least part of this increase is coming from the vast wetlands in Canada, Russia, and the Arctic. The methane in wetlands comes from naturally occurring bacteria, but study author Paul Palmer at the University of Edinburgh says the bacteria are producing more methane because the temperature is rising.
The higher the temperature, the more efficient they are at producing the methane.
So global warming is causing these wetlands to produce more methane, and the methane is causing more global warming.
This really does emphasize the fact that we are having this vicious cycle in the climate system, and we're seeing it now.
It's not yet to the stage where it's a runaway warming effect, Palmer says, but climate scientists are worried that we could hit that tipping point. There's no obvious way to control methane from natural wetlands, but at least half of methane emissions are from human activities, ranging from cattle rearing and natural gas exploration to coal mining. Since methane is the main ingredient of natural gas, efforts to capture it can actually pay for themselves. You can use the gas for energy. And Drew Schindel says, remember, methane contributes to ozone, which costs society real money because of its human health effects and because ozone also damages crops.
So if you account for all the economics, all the gains that you get through the benefits of controlling methane that are not even directly related to climate, you find that many of the reductions you could make actually pay for themselves.
So why is there relatively little effort now to control methane? Mohammed El-Ashri at the United Nations Foundation says part of the reason has been a fear by governments and advocates that attacking methane would be a dangerous distraction.
People are worried about diverting the attention away from carbon dioxide, and it shouldn't really be the case at all.
Both problems need to be solved sooner or later, but global methane projects practically ground to a halt last year. El-Ashri says that was partly because of uncertainty over the outcome of the global warming talks in Copenhagen, and partly because of the global financial crisis. There simply wasn't money to do projects, even though they were ready to go. El-Ashri is part of a group advocating for a new $200 million fund to help jumpstart these methane programs again.
Here is an opportunity to have some immediate effects in terms of impacts, particularly on the Arctic, as well as even secondary impacts like on health.
And the good thing about methane is it only stays in the air for about a decade. So if you can reduce emissions, you can see quick results. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Let's follow up next on the International Climate Conference that was held last month in Copenhagen. Governments of some of the world's most polluting countries are scheduled to announce next Monday how much they're willing to limit their emissions of gases linked to global warming. If they are serious about meeting their commitments, they will all have to give some serious thought to the coal that they use, NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
It used to be that coal was king in the U.S. It's still royalty. Half our electricity comes from it. But now coal is gwo wong, That's king in Chinese.
Coal is 80% of all power generation in China, and the Chinese use of coal is really one of the largest drivers of global coal consumption and hence global emissions.
That's Richard Morse, an energy analyst at Stanford University. Coal is the biggest single source of greenhouse gases. China and India are now huge consumers of coal, and their appetite is growing.
As long as economic development is a priority, I think climate takes a back seat. And in that situation, coal is going to win every time.
That's the conventional wisdom. But the deal made in Copenhagen may change that. By Monday, as many as 24 countries will have listed their emissions targets. China and the U.S., the two biggest coal users, are leading the group. India, another big coal power, is expected to join them. So will South Africa, a major coal exporter. So it's governments whose economies depend on coal who are now driving climate diplomacy by saying, okay, we'll cut our greenhouse gas emissions. And that means these countries will have to wrestle with the coal conundrum. We can't live without it, but we can't live with it. One energy expert who's watched this unfold is Trevor Hauser with the research firm RHG in New York. Hauser advised the U.S. climate team in Copenhagen. He says China actually might like to get off the coal train.
The coal in China is mined primarily in the northwest of the country, but the demand for that coal is in the east. And getting that coal from the mine to the power plant on the coast is a challenging and expensive undertaking.
2 years ago, an epic snowstorm shut down that supply chain. Power went out for millions of Chinese. Even China's trains stood still, stranding tens of thousands of people and a lot of coal. Hauser says it's the lack of a reliable and cheap way to transport coal that is pushing China to look for alternative fuels.
I think China has a strong incentive to move away from coal. I think there's going to be technical and economic challenges in doing it, but there's certainly a policy push to go that direction.
As for that other big consumer of coal, the U.S., the Obama administration has pledged to encourage more green energy from things like wind and solar power and to subsidize more efficient use of energy. But as energy economist Henry Jacoby of MIT points out, displacing coal is politically risky.
There are something like 22 states in the United States that have some level of coal production. Of course, that's not all the states that really care about it, because there are a number of other states whose electric power systems are heavily dependent on coal.
Jacoby points out something that politicians are loath to admit. Switching away from coal, which is cheap, so long as its negative environmental effects are not counted, will cost some consumers more on their utility bills.
If we don't have enough understanding of the climate issue for people to say, well, it's going to cost me a little bit more, but I think it's important enough. If we can't get to that point in the Congress, then we're not going to deal with the climate issue. It's a depressing thought.
But the Obama administration thinks there is an answer. Clean coal. That means extracting hydrogen from coal and using that to make electricity without emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The Department of Energy is spending $404 million this fiscal year to figure out how to do that. The Chinese government is also investing in the technology. So if coal does remain a big part of the energy mix for a few decades more, it may be by virtue of a new, untested technology whose final cost can only be guessed at. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
When hackers released some emails a couple of months ago of some of the world's leading experts on global warming, it caused them huge embarrassment. The messages revealed ugly sniping going on behind the public discourse. Climate change skeptics have pointed to those emails as evidence that global warming is a hoax. And even believers say the emails raise questions about scientific conduct. NPR's John Hamilton wanted to see just how hot things have gotten in the world of climate science, so he spent some time in Atlanta with researchers at the annual meeting of the American Meteorological Society.
The most notorious emails seem to discuss ways to prevent publication of research that challenged global warming. One also used the unfortunate word trick to describe a technique to massage temperature data. That sort of stuff has certainly made things more difficult for public figures trying to get limits on carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gases. But researchers in the trenches of climate science say there's really been no effect on the consensus that the Earth really is warming up. The trenches at the Meteorological Society meeting can be found in a vast underground chamber at the Georgia World Congress Center. It's filled with seemingly endless aisles of so-called poster presentations and their authors. Kevin Gobert of Valparaiso University in Indiana is standing in front of his poster describing trends in Australian cyclones.
Ultimately, I don't think there was anything within the emails that really, you know, caused a great debate within the scientific community about the validity of the climate science.
Not far away, Dave Gutzler from the University of New Mexico has a poster about 20th century droughts in the U.S. Gutzler says he and his colleagues tend to focus on climate data, not commentary, and he says the data haven't changed.
There are multiple lines of evidence that involve both completely independent data sets, such as glacier retreat, plus a whole body of modeling, plus a lot of process-based research about measuring heat in the oceans and things like that, that all point in the same direction.
But Gutzler says the emails have shown something most researchers already knew about climate science, but the public may not have.
It's contentious. It's sometimes nasty. That's because we're people. And we're dealing with problems that people care about very intensely, both for personal and professional reasons and because the public cares about it.
Marcus Williams is a graduate student at Florida State University whose poster describes temperature variability in the southeastern U.S. Williams says the nastiness of the emails has hurt the field, even if it hasn't undermined the science.
It did take a hit on our credibility somewhat. I mean, it's never good to have people kind of pushing false agendas out there.
The emails weren't part of the meeting's formal program, but they did come up frequently in sessions about climate. And one question scientists had was how to restore their damaged credibility. Chris Folland from the UK's Meteorological Office says one way would be to let everybody see the data that scientists have been using.
It would be very good to make all the data sets available that contribute to that land surface temperature data set and, of course, the sea surface temperature data sets. And indeed, all the other major data sets that are used in climate science.
Folland concedes that could be tricky, though, because much of the data is proprietary. Other researchers suggested a new focus on the ethical issues involved in publishing climate studies. They say the emails show that the peer review process can allow personal views rather than objective evaluation to affect where a paper gets published. Bill Hook is in charge of policy for the American Meteorological Society. He says climate researchers need to realize that they are now in a very bright spotlight and act accordingly.
This science has gone from science that's a sideshow in human affairs to science that matters, to science where people are placing billion-dollar and even trillion-dollar bets. And that requires a certain level of professionalism and caution about all communication.
Hook says the email incident has offered climate scientists a pointed reminder of just how much is at stake and how easily things can go awry. John Hamilton, NPR News.
A meteorite crashed through the roof of a doctor's office in Virginia earlier this week. No one was hurt. Still, it's a reminder of the space rocks that bombard our planet. They're usually really tiny. A few years ago, Congress told NASA to conduct a search for the big ones that might cause serious damage if they hit Earth. But as we hear from NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce, a new report says there's no way NASA will meet its deadline.
Congress wants NASA to be looking for icy comets and rocky asteroids close to Earth that are bigger than about 450 feet across, bigger than, say, a football field. NASA is supposed to find 90% of them by the year 2020, but here's the problem.
No matter what we do, it's now too late to meet the 2020 deadline that Congress set 4 or 5 years ago.
Michael Ahern is an expert on comets and asteroids at the University of Maryland. He served on a National Research Council committee that's just put out a new report called Defending Planet Earth. He says Congress didn't give NASA any special funding for the search, and the agency didn't ask for any.
If you set a deadline and then don't fund it, it's not going to happen.
He says NASA could finish the job close to the deadline if it built and launched a new space telescope. Or it could construct a new ground-based telescope and reach the goal by 2030. But either way, this would cost money.
You're talking about $1 billion over 20 years. That's $50 million a year.
far more than the $4 million a year that NASA currently spends. He says how much the government wants to devote to these searches is fundamentally a political decision. A huge impact that could wipe out humanity comes along only once in 100 million years. But a strike that could potentially flatten, say, a city might occur as often as once every few centuries. A NASA official said the agency has just received the new report, and it will take a couple of months to study it and respond to the committee. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Must be those strangers that come every night. Those saucer-shaped lights put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
NPR science correspondent Joe Palca tells us about a creature that has gone without for 30 million years.
Before we talk about no sex, let's talk about sex. From a biological perspective, sex requires a lot of work. It would be much easier if you could reproduce on your own.
You don't have to find a mate. If you find a mate, you don't have to worry about things like venereal disease. You don't have to worry about getting attacked while you're in the process of having a sex act.
That's evolutionary biologist John Logsdon of the University of Iowa. In addition to avoiding the dangers Logsdon mentions, if you could reproduce on your own, then your offspring would be an identical genetic copy of you, and quite possibly just as wonderful. Another reason to wonder about the advantages of sex.
Why would you mix up your genes at every generation when, in fact, you can pass 100% of your genes on every single time?
And yet nearly all multicellular organisms, and even some single-celled organisms, choose sex. Christopher Wilson is an evolutionary biologist at Cornell University.
What we get is females voluntarily sort of submitting their genes to this random lottery that goes on, where only half of them end up in an offspring, and half come from the sperm of some unrelated male, who really, in many species, contributes very little else.
Very little else. I'm not going to touch that. Moving on. What's up here? What in the world is sex good for? Wilson admits there are some advantages to sex.
And the advantage that many scientists have focused on is an advantage against diseases, infectious diseases, parasites, and pathogens.
The disease advantage comes because sexual reproduction brings in new genes. And John Logsdon says that can make a species hardier and more resistant to microbes.
Basically, you're shuffling the deck at every generation, and the good cards can come together by doing that shuffling.
So sex allows a species to change, and the positive changes help the species survive. But
if sex is so good, then what about organisms that can live without it?
And now we come to that creature that's had a really, really long dry spell.
No males required for 30 million years and no sex.
Chris Wilson is talking about microscopic, pond-dwelling, deloid rotifers.
They look like little worms about half a millimeter long, with two sort of rotating electric toothbrush heads on top that spin and filter food out of the water into their little sort of vacuum function mouth.
And all female. There's a fungus that likes to feed on deloid rotifers, but as Wilson describes in the current issue of Science magazine, the rotifer has a remarkable defense.
They enter a state that's called anhydrobiosis, that's life without water, and they essentially become little inanimate dust particles.
They're so desiccated in this state that there's nothing for the fungus to eat. And because the deloids are now nothing but dust, they can blow away with the wind, with luck landing in a new fungus-free pond.
By playing a game of hide-and-seek with the parasites, by constantly moving to new habitats, the rotifers can outrun their parasites without needing the variation that sex would provide.
So there you have it. Reduce yourself to dust and you can avoid sex. But wait, John Logsdon isn't totally convinced that deloid rotifers never have sex.
Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
In other words, just because nobody's ever seen a male rotifer, that's not proof they don't exist. Maybe they show up so rarely researchers just haven't been patient enough.
or maybe they don't like being watched. Logsdon thinks that every creature that's evolved enough to have a cell with a nucleus should be capable of sex. And rotifers definitely have cells with nuclei.
So I'm agnostic on sexuality or asexuality in deloid rotifers.
Uh-huh. So there's some hope for the deloid rotifer.
Well, you know, there's hope for sex, I guess. Yeah, if that's what you mean. That's funny.
Maybe not so funny for the rotifers. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
High school students Brenda Tan and Matt Kost recently spent 4 months testing the DNA of food items. They had help from researchers at Rockefeller University and the American Museum of Natural History.
I knew that we were going to, you know, be testing everything we could get our hands on, but I had no idea what we would find.
Matt Kost says of the 66 food items they tested, the DNA showed that 11 were mislabeled. Sheep's milk cheese was actually cow's milk, venison dog treats were beef, and the sturgeon caviar was Mississippi paddlefish.
Everything right is wrong again, just like in the long, long trailer. All the dishes got broken and the car kept driving, and nothing would stop to sever. And now the song is